Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. When you were in school, did a teacher ever threaten that if you got out of line, it would go on your permanent record? You know, some file somewhere, probably in the principal's office, that recounts every time you talked back in class, every fight you got into with a classmate, every participle you ever dangled. Well, these days, we sort of do have permanent records, digital ones anyway. What does it mean for students coming of age today that what they posted online when they were 13 might still be there when they're 18 or 30 or 40? As we share more and more of our lives on social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter, are we really considering the potential permanence of that information, that what we say and feel and do today may be with us for decades, even after we shuffle off this mortal coil? Today on Focus, we'll discuss whether we can escape from our digital selves and if the internet is truly becoming a compilation of our permanent record and what that means specifically for a generation that's come of age in a digital world. We have two guests with us this morning. Frances Harris is a librarian at University Laboratory High School in Urbana and a professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Library. Frances, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you with us. And Jules Polonetsky is director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum. That's a D.C.-based think tank seeking to advance responsible data practices. Jules, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
We also welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. I'd like to pose this to both of you, but Jules, let me start with you. Do we have a permanent record? Can we escape from our digital selves?
We certainly do have a permanent record, and I think we're seeing companies starting very slowly to respond a little bit, to give us a bit more power to curate and shape what's out there. But it's clear that many of us think that what we do on the internet is ephemeral. In the moment, it'll disappear. Who will care or pay attention? I'm just one person. I'm obscure. But indeed, much of this information can today be pulled and correlated and available, whether it's for targeted advertising or for researchers who are, you know, trying to find information about you. And indeed, could be used out of context in a way that would quite unnerve folks.
Frances, what do you think? Do we have a permanent record?
Definitely. So, and it happens in unexpected ways, as Jules is saying. If what you look at, what you type in, it's captured, and other folks are making profiles about you.
One impetus for discussing this topic today, Frances, was the return earlier this month of students to campus here at the University of Illinois. And a few of us here observed how the incoming freshman class has not lived in a world without the internet.
That's right. But I think in other ways, I don't want to be alarmist about this. I think that there are a lot more people more careful about it than we think, but they're up against ever-changing practices on the part of social network services. So as an example, the Pew Internet and American Life Project they published one of their studies in November, and one of the findings was that the vast majority of teens say they have private profiles visible only to friends rather than to the whole world. The problem is that when you sign up for services like that, you really have to stay on top of them because they change their privacy practices all the time. And even the forms, the new upgrade to the I just upgraded my iPhone, and I had to go through a whole other rigmarole to figure out how to do my Facebook privacy settings through that window.
So I think it's important to take a step back for a second, because social networks aren't what they once were, right? That many folks do a lot of activity outside of a social network, but as Frances explained, they might be hooking their iPhone to Facebook or Twitter so that they can, you know, log into sites using Facebook. So social media is now the internet. It is I might go to Facebook.com, but I even more likely might just be out on a website, and websites are now social, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, whether it's, you know, many other ways that sites want me to identify. And, you know, I think if you take a step further back even, our lives today are recorded in ways they've never been, right? We go through an easy pass or a smart tag, you know, as we commute to work. We log in and sign in to get in and out of buildings. I'm in Washington, D.C., here or in New York, you know, almost every major office building and in lots of other places around the world, you know, you might just be going for some random appointment, but you're showing your license and you're signing in. We're carrying mobile phones that are recording, you know, where we are. And then, of course, we're putting, you know, some information expressly online. So, you know, anyone living today, and particularly, you know, certainly the youth or the early adopters, are having every one of their activities from when they wake up to, you know, when they go to sleep, recorded and logged and available to somebody in some way.
Francis, is it your perception in talking with students, and you deal with students at the University Laboratory High School all the time, that they are aware of that shift, that change? Because when I talk about the idea of these kids coming of age in a world where the internet exists, it's beyond that. The shift now is that all of this information about us as individuals is pushed out to the world, not just taking information in from a variety of sources.
I think they're aware of it in a vague sort of way, but where they're coming from, especially our youngest students who are 12 and 13 years old, are coming from parents who are worried about stranger danger. And while that does happen, it's not really the main thing that is happening, and that they're not thinking that every time they use these free services or log in or check in or do any of those things that Jules was mentioning, things that don't cost money generally means that your information is the product. So they don't necessarily have that mindset. So we're trying to put a lot of emphasis now, I think a lot of educators are, on teaching you to manage your digital profile and be the one who can control whatever aspects of it you can control. It is everything. Our student newspaper is now online. If a student is written up in the local paper for sports, their names are on the internet. Actually, I think the kids get it more than their parents do. And so you want to make sure that that where you are mentioned and where there is information collected about you, to consider it your online resume. To plant things there when you can and take advantage of those things, it's really no longer a choice.
You know, Francis is quite right that the old sort of stranger danger warning, don't talk to people you don't know online, is, you know, maybe for the youngest audience, but for everyone else, it doesn't resonate anymore. They're living their lives online. They're interacting with each other. They might be interacting with a friend of a friend, and that's just not going to change. I think what we need to focus a bit more on is how can you put your best foot forward? How can you curate your online presence? You know, if you're out there today looking for a job or looking at college, and there's nothing about you on there, it's almost sort of a negative, a blank slate. Well, you know, where's the positive? Where's the award you won? Where's the, you know, certainly in the job market, it's quite common. We did a study a couple of years ago, which probably has only grown since then, but showed that almost 80% of recruiters, you know, do a quick web search before reaching out and checking a resume. And, you know, on one hand, if they didn't and someone turned out to be, you know, a well-known axe murderer or the like, you know, we'd say, well, why aren't you doing that? On the other hand, well, wait a second, what kind of information about those candidates are they seeing? Ironically, the social media mechanisms sometimes give you more control than that internet article, that newspaper story that doesn't reflect well on you, or the picture that someone put up on a blog. You can't do much about that. You might work with a service like Reputation.com or these other tools that try to, you know, deal with the fact that you come up high in Google as, you know, somebody who was in some embarrassing situation. But that's really hard to try to generate and get rid of that. Google won't take it down unless it's, you know, blatantly illegal. To some degree, the best chance you have to show others, and look, it's kids and teens looking up each other. It's colleges, it's employers, it's people going on dates. I mean, we are all, you know, we talk about Big Brother as sort of these businesses or maybe the government, but we're all little brothers, and we, you know, we whip out our phone and we investigate, you know, things about each other that is now available. Our goal, I think, needs to be to remind them, just like your parents, you know, years ago said, you know, you got to put your best foot forward, to help people take control. If we spend our time saying hide or don't be a teen, I mean, teens do stupid things. College kids do stupid things, right? I mean, that's the reality. They you know, they might drink somewhere. They might, you know, use profanity. They might, you know, do the kinds of things that, you know, every generation is sort of, oh my God, I can't believe the you know, that's the wild stuff that those younger folks are doing. We need to help them, and I think they do get it. There was a wonderful story in today's New York Times about the college sort of dating bar scene and how students, they spend the morning after furiously untagging pictures, you know, that have been posted of them sort of drinking. It's part of the next morning, you know, you see, you go out, you have a good time, the next morning you go check what your friends posted, and, you know, you don't take the picture down, but you untag it so that it doesn't easily show up, you know, when people look you up. It's part of life. We hire a lot of young law students, and as they go to the job search, they tweak their name so that their prospective employer doesn't see the personal profile that they've had, or they, you know, suddenly blank out their profile to, you know, any other than their sort of closest friends. So they're getting savvy. We need to help them do more. Frankly, we need to help all of us do more. But I think if we say to them, hide, or just don't curse, or, you know, don't ever drink, I mean, it's not the reality of their lives. We need to focus a bit more on, you know what, you're in public a lot of the time, and you need to make sure that what's available about you represents you well, so that somebody who's looking you up, whether it's a date or a friend or an employer or a college, you know, sees your authentic best foot forward instead of your worst moments.
I totally agree. I do, though, try to make sure that our students know that if something is put up about them that they object to or don't like, and reaches that level of either harassment or defamation, that they can complain to Facebook, and Facebook will take it down if it's. But yeah, you gotta watch it. You gotta Google yourself, all the time.
It's not even maybe a question of, you know, it used to be thought of as, well, it's sort of a vanity to Google yourself.
No.
But in truth, it's a question of protecting an image, perhaps.
Yeah, and we can't say to them, you know, why are you putting this all up there anyway? I mean, this is the reality of life, not only for the younger audience, but for, you know, anybody who's been using these technologies. You are connecting, you are sharing, they're finding, you know, huge value in it. It's where their community is. The community is not, you know, hanging out at the bar as much or you know, socializing elsewhere. It is now the public space where they spend with their friends. You know, some of them feel that they've got more privacy there than they had at home. I mean, just think about it. The typical teen, you know, at home, someone calls your house. Well, your parents might, you know, pick up the phone and say, well, who is it, you know, before handing it on to you. If you spent, you know, 4 hours on the phone talking to 12 different people, well, you know, they'd probably know about it and want to know, you know, who are all these people that you're interacting with. Online, they can do much of this out of sight, even though it's possibly findable, but it's often at a sight of their parents or the adults. And if we spend our time being, you know, shocked and saying, don't put anything out there, if it's on the internet, it's there forever, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, goes in one ear and out the other ear. We need to have the same sort of conversations that, you know, parents who are responsible always had. You know, you're going to go to a party. I'm not going to be there. You know, if wildness ensues, you want to think about whether, you know, you call me or whether this is something that, you know, you want to be drawn into. You could be drawn in. Your friends could be doing something. Your friends could be drinking. You know, you need to, you know, remember that you could, you know, ruin your future for, you know, what is sometimes very tempting, you know, engagement. And the same thing can happen online. People are teasing somebody, and, you know, it's easy to just lash out or, you know, do something that you think is anonymous because it seems to be online, be aware that your good friend could pass that on to someone else and you could ruin your friendships. You know, if some friend reaches out to you and says, you know, didn't so-and-so say this horrible thing or doesn't he look fat or, you know, you name the kind of catty nastiness that, that happens in real life, recognize that if you do that online, you know, that friend all of a sudden feels differently about you tomorrow and sends it to, you know, your peer group and you're stuck. So, you know it's not only something that's going to be there for your employment record, but you can, you can really be hurt with your peer group or with people who you want to deal with if you don't keep in mind that you're in a public space when you say these things, and what seems to be private because of the technology can so easily be relayed.
Right.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and as we share more and more of our lives on sites like Facebook and Twitter, privacy concerns naturally do arise, but so does the issue of how long this material will exist, maybe much longer than any of us had originally intended. In an age of social media and digital archiving, can we escape from what we've posted or written online? Is the internet compiling a permanent record of our lives, the one that grade school teachers and principals have been warning students of for decades? That's the topic of today's show, your permanent record. My guests are Francis Harris, a professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Library and a librarian at the University Laboratory High School Library in Urbana, and Jules Polonetsky, director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum, a D.C.-based think tank seeking to advance responsible data practices. We welcome you to the conversation this morning, and specifically we'd like to know how you navigate social networking sites and other resources online and through technology today, and whether you take into consideration the potential permanence of everything that you post. If you want to engage in a little digital irony, you can share your comments or questions on WILL's Facebook page. You could also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or if you prefer the old-fashioned way, we welcome your phone calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Francis, it occurs to me that thus far what we've been talking about really deals with the short term, how people will react or respond to something that you post today, tomorrow. But there's a long-term component here. This stuff stays in some way for years, decades, maybe the rest of our lives or beyond. Do you have the perception that students coming of age today understand that what they post online or what they posted online maybe when they were 13, because, you know, Facebook was around, MySpace was around then, might still be there now that they're 18 or maybe when they're 30 or 40 or beyond?
Oh, yes and no. We certainly talk to them about it. there's a story we tell every semester about in our computer lab, somebody had pegged to the bulletin board. They'd printed out an email message, and it was a little sweet email from a boy to a girl asking her to a dance. And the teacher who found it noticed that the boy was in the lab at the time and took it down and showed it to him, and he looked very surprised because it was something like 4 years old. I mean, that this was a long time ago, and that email was from even longer ago, and it was also funny that it emerged as a printed artifact. But it's a story that we continue to tell them to sort of press that point. Or as another example, that guy who was joined the Taliban, they called him the American Taliban several years ago, they were able to trace back all of his Usenet postings, which goes back to kind of a pre-web internet. But as you say, and as Jules has said, you can talk about this and tell kids that doesn't necessarily mean that it sticks with them. On the other hand, I think they're really thoughtful about it in ways that we might not expect. And
can you give some examples of that?
They're getting pretty good at blocking. We show them how to block people, and I am aware that they may do this with parents, but what's important to me is that they're understanding the media and how to if they're even using it as a control mechanism. I think they are less likely now to friend a lot of people. We're actually finding some students who are opting out of the social network scene for a while and then maybe opting back in later, or they go in gung-ho and then step out. They are also using it to ask for help sometimes, and I see that as a positive way of using social media and finding trusted people. They're being somewhat selective in who they friend. I think, at least with our students, I think we're a little bit past that time when they were, you know, seeing who could get the most friends mm-hmm. ever.
Yeah, you know, Dana Boyd, a friend of mine who's just a wonderful researcher in this area, has done a lot of good work documenting what youth are doing, sometimes just by kind of, I'd say, hacking the system on their own to make it work the way they want. You know, we'll see people deactivating temporarily their social media accounts during finals because they realize that they can't study when their friends keep pinging them. We'll see folks who, you know, keep their Facebook profile because that's sort of where everyone is, but now that they're friends with 500 people, there still is this core of their 8 pals, and so they'll go create a private Twitter account that only those 8 are on, so that, you know, they can still have the everybody, but they can have their little, you know, subgroup of exclusive friends and communicate with them. You'll see people sometimes having 2 profiles, sort of a public one that's not all that active, and their parents know about that one, and then a much more active second profile that's sort of their real profile. We'll see people sort of doing the untagging that we talked about earlier, you know, eliminating the name that their friend put on their picture so as to make sure that although maybe it's up, it won't show up on their page. Or frankly, asking. I mean, if you follow some of these accounts, you'll see folks saying, "Ugh, please, you know, take that one down. You're killing me." You know, they do react. You'll see people talking in code almost. You know, they know that their parent is their friend because that was the deal when they got their account, or they know they may have some adults or others. And so rather than saying, Dana does a great job sort of describing someone who broke up and didn't want their, you know, mother jumping into the conversation and, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry you're feeling so bad," and mortifying her in front of a friend. So, you know, posted some lyrics from a song and, you know, they all got it, but, you know, the adults didn't. And so they make it their own in some interesting ways. You'll see many girls listing themselves as being married to other girls, and
yes,
they're not doing that to make a statement about their partner. It's their best friend, and Facebook doesn't have a way for you to list your best friend, and so, well, you just say that you're married to that best friend, and everyone kind of gets it in that audience. So they you know, we need to give them some more credit, I think, than many give when we say, well, the youth don't care about privacy. You know, they do. They care about privacy from their parents. They care about privacy from, you know, adults who they may be connected with. And it'll be interesting to see whether society catches up a little bit as well. You know, part of what we have going on now is we've got these norms, and we don't know what's right. I'm connected to some of my babysitters because, well, that's the easiest way to, you know, ping them and schedule. They know I could see their pages, but I know they think I was really creepy if I, you know, commented on their vacation pics or you know, saw them and said, "Oh, it looked like you were doing that." No, it's not for me. I know I can access it, but should I? And so I think we're going to see those boundaries. You know, we have employers who have been accused of asking for people's, you know, Facebook credentials, and then there's sort of this lashback and legislation passing in states saying, you know, employers are not allowed to do that. You know, what makes an employer think that, you know, that's part of their background check that they can do? They would never ask for your personal email passwords. You know, "Could I have your email password? I'd like to go through, you know, your correspondence, you know, on Gmail, so for 5 years before I hire you." But somehow, you know, some thought, "Well, I ought to look at your Facebook profile." So part of it is society as well starting to recognize, you know, I might be invited into your home, and if you left your diary out, I probably shouldn't grab it just because it's on the table and I'm legally in your home and maybe I'm not violating any law, but I shouldn't do that. right? I shouldn't repeat something you told me in confidence, and also I probably shouldn't forward that email or, you know, negotiate those boundaries, you know. So some folks would like laws to protect this, but to some degree, I think part of this is sort of the ethical guidelines. I don't peek in your window. I mean, I might be able to see in from the street, but it would be wrong if I did that. And we don't yet understand, adult or young, well enough. You know, I can look up in certain states your traffic record, whether you've got speeding tickets. And I guess if I was interviewing a nanny who was going to drive my kids to school, that might be cool. But is it cool to do that for, like, the people in your carpool? Like, they're driving your kids, but I don't know. It seems a bit weird if you, like, did a full background check, even though that's there today. It's available, you know, on the other people, you know, the other parents. They'd probably think you were a bit weird. And so we don't – the ethics of our personal distance – and what's right and what's wrong haven't yet caught up with the new technology capabilities that let us each, you know, government or employer or college or, you know, individual properly respect those personal spaces.
Francis, do you get into those sort of ethical questions with students?
Definitely. And we do it in a variety of ways. Probably the most direct way is through a required computer literacy course that we have. And there we use a variety of scenarios and just kids respond to each other in an online forum, and then we have a conversation in class about it. And so it's exactly the kinds of things that Jules is talking about. One example, one of those scenarios that we've been using is group of three people are at a park, and one kid takes pictures and posts them and then makes suggestive captions, which have nothing to do with what the kids were actually doing, and is sort of a third party friend. And then as a consequence, the girl whose pictures are taken is dropped by the people who are babysitters. And so we have or that she babysits for, sorry. Mm-hmm. And so we have a conversation in class about those parents. Are they creeping on her to look at her at her pictures on Facebook, or are they not? And because from their point of view, any adult, even if they're friends with those adults, it seems very, very creepy. But this gives them makes them think about it, you know. I stand up there and say, look, I'm a mom. I want to know if my babysitters are, you know. And then that's when we talk about what recourse do you have. And I think it's really important to bring these kinds of conversations into the school setting, which leads me to a little soapbox of mine, which is that I think it's mostly not brought into the school setting because schools in general have taken kind of a blind eye to social networks and the impact of social networks, and for the most part block them, even though technically they don't violate any laws or rules. The filtering software that most schools install is there because of the Children and Internet Protection Act, which is actually rather specific in what it regulates, and that's supposed to be material harmful to children and images, and that's really nothing to do with social networks and or even some commercial sites that are routinely blocked in schools. And so it takes it out of the hands. I mean, schools, it makes it very difficult for them to bring into a school setting for any kind of conversation because they're blocked. So it's having this hypothetical conversation about something that you couldn't.
Well, I imagine on one hand there's the thought that, well, if we allow these sites into schools, then kids will be focusing on those the whole day. They won't be paying attention to what's going on in class. But on the flip side of it, if you block it all, then are you reflecting the world that those kids are living in and the way they're getting access to and pushing out information?
Exactly. And I think a lot of kids actually use Facebook for help with homework. This is routine. And I, as a librarian, will accept friend requests from students on Facebook, because what they do is chat with me at night and ask for help on their assignments. And I really do my best not to creep on them.
Say creep on them, what do you mean by that? Define that.
Well, it's exactly as Jewel said, to make comments on the pictures they posted from their birthday party or whatever. There's sort of a split personality thing going on there with students, where they want you to be there, but they sort of don't want you to look at them.
Hmm.
When they're alumni, I feel much more comfortable in doing that. But when they are current students, I generally don't.
And the reality is, so the tools are there. Mm-hmm. They're just not that easy to use. And most of the adults, or certainly, you know, many of the teachers, are not power users. I mean, this mm-hmm. is not what they do all day. And if you're not a really devoted user, and, you know, I'm a very devoted user. We get more action on our Future of Privacy Forum Facebook page than we do, you know, at our website, and people connect to us there, and many of our members and supporters, you know, will interact and post, and so and we spend a lot of time working with Facebook and Twitter and the others. But I find that, you know, I just can't be bothered sometimes to do something very nuanced. Someone will make a request, and I don't know them that well. You know, maybe I met them one time and they want to connect, so I want to be agreeable and I want to connect, but maybe they don't need to see, you know, everything about my entire life. So I could accept them, you know, as a limited friend. I could create a category, you know, people I met once but don't really know that well, or, you know, students could have, you know, teachers who they want to request so they can interact with and share some information, but maybe not my pictures, maybe not the things on my wall. And you can do that. Mm-hmm. You just need to, you know, really get comfortable, and it's just not that easy yet. And it used to be completely unusable. I think Facebook made it a lot easier to use, but most of us, you know, just chug through the day, and unless you're really sort of a public figure, you don't really take the time to have my fully public information, my friends, my, you know, some people I know, but maybe they don't need full access. It's doable, but it's not intuitive to us. And we have to, the businesses have to make this, you know, so easy that we do it without thinking. I rented a car the other day in a strange city, and it was a model car I'd never driven before. But I got in, I didn't read the manual, and no one briefed me. I didn't sit through a lecture. I got in and I drove this, like, machine of death that could kill people if I didn't know how to drive it, right? And things kind of were in the right place. Like, I had to figure out where to put the lights on, but everything else, you know, sort of worked. And we need that. We need the tools to be that easy. Once we tell someone they're going to have to sit and be trained on it, you know, we've lost them. This has got to be so intuitive that when I get online, it makes sense to me. You know, Apple has been, I think, working on this, you know, problem. Facebook works on this problem, but I don't think anyone has nailed it yet and made it easy enough for the average user. Look, they just want you to sign up and, you know, put your information and start using. And if they started saying to you, you know, do you really want to post this picture? You know, it would slow down their business. And so I think they have to get that right balance right. But the tools are there, and I think we need to have, you know, an audience that are sophisticated power users. If someone comes in and they're all about, you know, here's the dangers of being on social media and here's how you should protect yourself, that just doesn't go over. Mm-hmm. If you don't come in there with a passion for, well, look at all the great things you can do. You're going to connect with teachers, with information you need, with, you know, you've got shy kids who never would have spoken up, and because they're able to do it online, they'll connect with a group, they'll connect with you know, with friends. I mean, there is so much value to their lives. They've got an identity that they'd never express in person, but, you know, online they've got, you know, this whole interest that they're able to explore and blow out there. When we come in with the, I don't see why you'd want to do this, in fact, we block it in the school in the first place, as opposed to, this is a powerful force. There are revolutions, you know, being fomented because people can spread ideas around the world. You know, this is how you're going to spend your college days, you know, meeting and interacting. So That's great. Now, here's how you can use it more effectively to make sure that you're not embarrassed, that you're not inadvertently, you know, leaving a record that's going to, you know, hurt you. Here are the tools that are there. They're not that hard to use. Here's how you can be a power user. The safety, the hide, you know, we sound like we're coming from another planet and not recognizing that this is their life. And we're just lecturing at an unreceptive audience. If we come in and we understand why they're there and how powerful this media is, and how core it is to their lives, and how and they're cynical, they understand. These are businesses, they're ad-supported. I mean, they're not naive about, you know, who they're doing business with. They don't think this is like a big charitable thing, you know, set up to just make their lives fun. They're cynical about the advertising and the promotion, and they know how to tune out. You know,
I'm going to stop you there just because I want to get into that advertising and also get to some listener emails in just a couple of minutes. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are Frances Harris, professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Library. She's a librarian at the University Laboratory High School Library. Also with us is Jules Polonetsky, director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum, a D.C.-based think tank seeking to advance responsible data practices. We're discussing the potential permanence of our digital selves, how in a world where hundreds of millions of people connect every day through social networking, every piece of information we push out could be there for a very, very long time, that we may in fact have a sort of digital permanent record, just like the one your teachers warned you about back in school. We welcome you to the conversation this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll get to your questions or comments in just a minute. We are due for a break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, how electricity functions in our bodies. We talk with physiologist Frances Ashcroft, author of the new book, The Spark of Life. Her groundbreaking research in 1984 involving electricity in the body led to a major new treatment for neonatal diabetes. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Champaign Public Library and the Urbana Free Library, sponsors of CU Reading, encouraging everyone in Champaign-Urbana to read the same book, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Related events run from September 30th to October 28th. Details at cureading.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing the potential permanence of our digital selves on today's show. My guests are Frances Harris, a librarian with the University Laboratory High School in Urbana, a professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Library, and Jules Polonetsky, director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum. We welcome you to the conversation as well, and specifically, we'd like to know how you navigate social networking sites, whether you take into consideration the potential permanence of everything that you post. Call us with that or any other comments or questions you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have several questions to share with both of you. Amy writes in with a couple of questions. She asks, I wonder why most discussions about privacy and ruined futures due to social media center around youth and not around users in general. She says, with senior social media users on the rise and Facebook recently cited as involved in many divorces, are damaged futures not a concern for all?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, for me, obviously, it's, kids are what I know, and that those are the folks I work with. But I think one of the things we're learning is that young people are catching on much faster than maybe their elders. And I can't tell you how many middle-aged people I've talked to whose elderly parents are now getting on and just have no filters whatsoever and put anything out there and are not getting it. So it could be that we'll see things change over time as our culture becomes, it's more infused generally. But I think, you know, the statement, the kids are all right, that some of the older folks could learn from what's going on.
You know, it's election season, and anybody who's on Facebook now probably who's listening to this is probably saying, you know what, I have friends, colleagues, you know, people I'm connected to. My God, the way they're talking about politics, or the language they're using. You know, they'd never curse or, you know, use the sort of, you know, very polarizing, you know, kind of stuff that, you know, exists on blogs, but now it's under their name and it's being said to, you know, an audience that who knows who's going to see it, and it's their colleagues, and you're seeing adults for the first time, and we have a particularly, you know, polarizing election with the country, you know, having very strong feelings often about one candidate or another. And so you're seeing for the first time now that Facebook is, you know, ubiquitous. It's true. Everybody's on now, right? I mean, there's only a small audience that isn't. They've got, you know, more than 100 million users in the U.S., and there are only 100-something million, you know, Internet users in the U.S. So it's you know, coming to saturation. So everyone's on there. And so this is really the first time where the general, you know, average Joe who has something to say, has a megaphone of, you know, 100 friends to say it to, and the adults, frankly, maybe need a bit of an education because people are being unfriended. There's just horrible, you know, terrible rhetoric going on. So indeed, this is not a kids and teens issue, and, you know, maybe we're worried about, you know, kids and teens, you know, getting that first job, but, boy, there are plenty of employed people who are, you know, who ought to be aware that when their next job comes along or when their boss's boss, you know, sees sort of the nasty, you know, rhetoric that they've used, it can certainly be harmful to them as well.
Francis Amy also writes that Web 2.0 has a philosophy of you build it, we profit. And she asks, how might a societal desire or need to express oneself online be tied to a few others' profits? And is this aspect of the Internet discussed in computer literacy classes?
I'm not. Can you repeat the second part of that?
So basically she's asking whether or not the fact that people expressing their opinions about issues or liking things on Facebook, the fact that that's tied to a few companies,
yes,
corporations out there profiting from it, and as a result, that it's not so much a question of expressing oneself as serving a marketing world, I guess,
right.
Maybe, and whether that's something you get into in classes.
Yes, I mean, that goes back to the problem. If when you're using a source that doesn't cost you any money, it generally means that you and your information are the product. It always amuses me when Facebook makes a change and there's great hue and cry and people are complaining about it, but they're doing it, they're participating, and they're not paying for it. And another example I've seen lately that's particularly troublesome is that schools are using, or companies are using Facebook in concert with schools to raise money. Go to Target or go to this store and like something, and Target will give your school the X number of dollars. And that I find particularly dangerous. But there's also a flip side to it, which is the gigantic open source community, so that you have things where people are pooling their knowledge, and I think Wikipedia is one example of that, but say something like WordPress or Drupal or these sites where people are building products together and sharing their knowledge in ways that's just unprecedented. And I think that can really be the best of the Internet, and I'd like to see students sort of take hold of that some more.
Let's...
Yeah, I think we have sort of a love-hate relationship with Internet advertising. On one hand, we don't want to pay for stuff. The biggest groups in Facebook complaining about things have been the ones who heard rumors that Facebook might charge, and then they, you know, millions of people say, no, keep it free. But then on the other hand, you know, we object to the advertising. That might be starting to change in the future. You know, no one paid for music, right? Everyone stole music or downloaded, you know, music. And, well, when it became easy enough to pay not that much, you know, with iTunes, well, now you buy music. The app world, right, this is all moving to mobile, and particularly the young audience. They're accessing this on their smartphones. The Internet advertising model doesn't work as well there. It's like this little tiny ad, and it's even tinier when it's on your phone. And so apps, people buy apps. A lot of them are free and ad-supported, but people seem to be ready to pay 99 cents, $1.95, and so forth. You know, most of the media, the newspaper world, is not doing that well with sort of an ad-supported Internet. They're not, you know, replacing their advertisers with those banner ads, whether, you know, no matter which publication they are. And so paying a small amount as opposed to, you know, having some giant internet advertiser or earn a small amount from millions of users adding up to a lot of money, I think when we keep an eye on what's happening in mobile and the way mobile is going to be monetized, it might shift. Now, that might mean we pay something, so whether or not people love that shift or not, we'll see. But if the amount is small enough and all you got to do is click, well, it seems to be working for music. It might work for, and it's working for, you know, many, many apps. Apple's paid out more than $6 billion to app developers, you know, offering sometimes very trivial little, you know, play Scrabble with your friends or poke people. So that might change over time.
We have just about 5 minutes left. I'm going to ask both of our guests to keep your responses relatively short here, see if we can get through as many calls and emails as we can. Let's go to Jeff in Piatone. Jeff, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I love this. Yeah, it's frustrating. I'm one of those guys that might complain a little bit. But I'm a small guy, and it seems like us small guys are being squeezed out in our business. I went the cheaper route. It's actually cheaper to go Facebook than it is to go into papers. And the downfall is I'm reaching the whole world. I'm not reaching just a locale, you know. I try to build my business on it. I'm learning the computer trade as I'm in the mid-50s. And I'm having a blast, although it does get frustrating after a while. And some of the stuff, I'm kind of slow in trying to learn it, but I'm enjoying it. The problem I see is that everybody wants something from you, no matter what it be, whether it's right or wrong. And I think, you know, I'm fairly bashing us guys that are trying to complain about how much they're charging. The problem is they charge a lot more than somebody else would charge. And I don't mind paying the fees, but it's in excess. And the problems that I've been having on Facebook and some of the other sites far exceed what I think it's worth money-wise. I mean, I can only buy so much and put so much into my own computer.
Right.
You know, and the security problem seems to be a big threat on a lot of these sites. And it's like, unless you're some kind of corporate guru or something, you know, like a Sears or a Walmart or a Target, and you spend buku bucks on top-of-the-line security, you're going to have all kinds of problems. And since I'm developing stuff, I don't want people to steal my stuff.
All right, you know, Jeff, I'm going to have to stop you there. I apologize, but you're bringing up a number of different topics, and I want to give our guests a chance to comment on some of what he was raising. So he's coming at it from the standpoint of an employer who wants to advertise maybe on some of these social networking sites. And as a result is finding that maybe it's economically not beneficial to him to do so, or as much so for larger corporations that maybe can very specifically target audiences. But I think everybody kind of can't they, on these sites?
Well,
they use them correctly?
Yeah, you can just have a Facebook page that describes your service. But I think, and probably Jules is going to be better at answering this one, but to actually have your ad appear on the sidebar costs money.
Yeah, without question.
Yeah.
Indeed, you can micro-target here in a way you can on the the general web. I can choose, you know, students in Illinois who are left-handed, who've said they like, you know, Coca-Cola or whatever, and only show my ad, you know, to them. That's sort of been the big driver of advertising on some of these social media, that you've put so much information there that advertisers can really get exactly the kind of folks they, you know, they want.
Well, you know, when we talk about this sense of permanence, anything that we put out there that could be there for decades or throughout our lifetimes or beyond, that's true also for advertisers, isn't it? That anything that they advertise, in some way, there's some footprint of that.
Well, the problem advertisers have is they're out there, and you know, this is not just a place where they can advertise. It's a place where people can say things they don't like about those advertisers. So, you know, you're out there saying, hey, buy my product. Well, there are people out there saying, I did, and it stinks, and here's what's wrong with it, and go to hell, and blah, blah, blah. And so, the advertisers have to be ready to jump into sort of this, you know, engaging with users means actually responding to them. So, you know, I think we're seeing advertisers really trying to understand how do they, you know, A, does it work? I mean, people are busy, they're posting. Are they, you know, clicking on ads when they're, you know, trying to talk to their friends? How do they know that it works, and can they track the ads well enough Facebook has some actually pretty strict rules that keep the advertisers from sort of taking that data with them, and they don't like that. They like taking the data with them. And so, you know, there's a lot of busy work. You know, we should say one quick word about Do Not Track, which is a proposal that in Washington and in the various web standards group has emerged as sort of a backlash to some of this tracking by advertisers to give users one way that they can just say, you know, I can say do not call me on the Do Not Call list. Is there a way to, you know, give me a button on my browser that will give me privacy in a simple do not track way? And so there's a lot of work going on to see if that can be resolved.
And I want to say there's a search engine that called DuckDuckGo, which I've been introducing to my students, that does not claims not to track you and also claims not to put you in a filter bubble, which means, as Google does, which it tries to learn your preferences and only show you things it thinks you want to see, which tends to reinforce what you're thinking and believing, and
Since we're nearly out of time, I want to share one more comment with both of you from Rona, who writes and says, as a mother to four teenagers, I've been very clear with my children. When it comes to the internet, it's no different than real life.
Yes.
Actions have consequences, some dire and permanent. Do not do anything in real life or online that you would not want to explain to your children and grandchildren. She says, for an example, I remind them of the embarrassing stories that my family still tells of my exploits as a child and teenager. They may think they're funny, but are they prepared for everyone to be sharing similar stories about them when they are adults?
That's fabulous. The ethical issues are exactly the same. You just have a broader audience.
Frances Harris is a librarian at University Laboratory High School in Urbana and a professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Library. Frances, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Craig.
And Jules Polonetsky is director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum, a D.C.-based think tank seeking to advance responsible data practices. Jules, thank you for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with the filmmakers behind a documentary airing on public television in the coming days called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women. We'll hear some clips from the film and talk about it. That's on tomorrow's show. Hope you can join us then. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Kyle Mabries, our technical director, and handles your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.